Welcome back, guys. DGS and KMOX, a few minutes past 4 p.m. Happy Friday. Happy Friday the 13th, which is beating the crap out of Andrew. He started the show with, I'm afraid of Friday the 13th. I believe in it. And he has just tripped himself up at every possible chance.
Caught in the loop.
Yep. It's been a tough one. It's not been an easy one.
You better sit out a couple innings.
I know. I'm going to have to, I'm going to be driving home like 20 miles an hour. Which is not weird for me.
In the left lane, of course.
Yeah, in the left lane.
Bernie Miklas is now part of the KMOX team. You can find Bernie online on YouTube. You can also find him at Scoops with Danny Mac, and he's with us on Mondays and Fridays with Amy and Chris on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Bernie, how's it doing total our Sports Open line the other night with Paulie?
No, I had a good time. We also, you know, with Tom Ackerman last Sunday and just moving all around, hopping on show to show to show. Great stuff, man. I'm so happy to be back in the family.
So next Saturday, the 21st, is a celebration of the greatest show on turf, 25th anniversary at Busch Stadium. And Isaac Bruce and a bunch of players are going to be there. You can get more information about that at cardinals.com/greatest show on turf. Bernie, where in your sky of sports stories you've covered in St. Louis is the greatest show on turf?
Well, it was the most improbable success that I've ever seen. Like, listen, I take nothing away from all the World Series championships, the Cardinals and the pennants they've won. But the Cardinals were already at a very high level in terms of expectations and standards, established success at a high level. So when they won, I'm not saying that we just said, well, it's no big deal. Of course, it's a big deal. But it wasn't unforeseen. It wasn't a miracle. That was who they were. And when the Blues won the Stanley Cup in 2019, it was remarkable, and it took 50 years to do it, and generations of hockey fans waited for that dream to come true. But again, the Blues were a good team. Very rarely were they a terrible team. They got to the playoffs all the time. It was just a matter of them breaking through. But the Rams thing came out of nowhere. I mean, they moved to St. Louis and they had a losing record, 95, 96, 97, 98. And the year before the greatest show year, I mean, they were 4-12 and they averaged about 16 points per game. Their offense was dead. They had no playmakers. It was depressing to watch. And then all of a sudden, wow, it was like maybe the greatest single season offense in the history of the NFL. I mean, they went 13-3. They averaged 33 points per game. They had the league MVP in Kurt Warner. They had Marshall Faulk, who had over 1,000 yards rushing and receiving. You had Torrey Holt as a rookie, Isaac Bruce as a all-galaxy wide receiver, and the defense played really, really well too. So to go from 4-12 and being a chronic loser to being the best team in the NFL and doing it with an incredibly entertaining style, a theatrical style and an exciting style. I know they upgraded the roster before that season, but no one saw a Super Bowl parade in our visions in downtown St. Louis going into that season.
You know, the way when I discussed this earlier, Bern, this is one of those things that transcends the market, right? So like the Cardinals winning in 2011, it was a big deal here, but it wasn't like a thing that baseball fans all over the country are going to remember forever. They might remember the Freeze home run or his triple to right field, but they're not, it's not going to look at, you're not going to look, but this whole season of the greatest show on turf is more like 85 Bears. It's, you know, it's one of those unique things that dominated the sport, not just the city where that championship team played in.
No, that's right. And the thing of it was, that was an incredible season, and it was the only Super Bowl, although they did win the NFC Championship 2 years later and lost to the Patriots, a game they should have won in Super Bowl 36. But the greatest show on turf was really a three-year show. I mean, it was a three-year engagement. I mean, there's been teams now since then who have scored, you know, 500 points in a season. Right. But this team scored 500 plus points 3 years in a row and only lost 12 games. And you just couldn't stop them. You just simply could not stop them. It was just a question of, A, would the defense be good enough? And in 2000, it wasn't. And B, you know, would you stumble in the postseason? And they did stumble against the Patriots because Bill Belichick, despite what people think here, you know, he wasn't cheating. He just had a really great game plan and the Rams never adjusted. So I'll never forget those days. That was a stunning, beautiful thing to watch. And I hope that this team is not overlooked and forgotten, even in St. Louis,
yeah,
because it moved to Los Angeles. There's no reason to be seething at these players, these group of men who gave us such an incredible, incredible show and the only Super Bowl success. 49 seasons of NFL football in St. Louis. One Super Bowl, and these were the group of men that did it. And plus, you've got five Hall of Famers now, including Dick Vermeil, and Torrey Holt will make it six at some time soon. So you just saw a legendary team with legendary players. And Kurt Warner, one of the great individual stories, yep, coming out of nowhere of all time in that league.
So the Rams leaving and the way they left and Kroenke and the lawsuits and the money paid, how big of a black eye is that on the NFL? Or do they kind of don't care, they've moved on?
Honestly, Dave, they don't care. They realized that they were going to get their butts kicked in court and it would be really, really ugly. Plus, the owners were starting to fight amongst themselves. It's mm-hmm. like, hey, why should we have to pay the legal bills for this? We're going to get slaughtered in court and Kroenke should pay for all of it. And then you had the Kroenke owners siding with him. You had the other side led by Robert Kraft and some others. So there was all kinds of infighting and it was getting uglier and uglier and uglier. So they had to basically pay nearly $1 billion to settle the thing. But I still have fans and God bless them, man. I understand to say like, well, is there a chance we'd ever get an expansion team? No, we're not. There's going to be bad blood because of that big dispute. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also when the NFL expands, they're not going to put a team in the US. They're going to go international. That's why I treasure what we had here with the Rams over those 3, 4, 5 years.
It's an amazing thing too, Bern, and I know it gets frustrating for people in St. Louis because that story never got covered enough on the bigger picture, right?
Right.
Like of here, course. We covered it, and you know, ESPN would barely touch it. Although, you know, tip of the cap to Michelle Smallman, she brought it up earlier in this preseason, leading up to the year on the morning show there on ESPN Radio. But the national football people tend to fall in line. They don't tend to go after the league or question the league. There are a few, like the guys that do outside the lines do, you know, Don Van Natta and I'm forgetting.
Seth Wickersham did a great piece, and a very comprehensive, well-reported piece on the travesty of that relocation process that stripped the Rams out of St. Louis. He did not hold back. He aired out a lot of dirty laundry. So it was a great piece. When I was doing radio shows at the time, I mean, I would just refer to the national media as basically state-run NFL media.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was state-run. I mean, this was like the old Soviet Union days with the TASS news agency, right? Seriously, they could care less about what happened to St. Louis. I mean, you know, those people at the NFL Network were all but doing cartwheels the night that the vote went through.
Right.
You know,
because they were going to move their offices to L.A.,
right. And, you know, I'll never forget, there's one person who had integrity from a media standpoint. Nate Burleson at that point, now he's on CBS, of course, and CBS. He was in an NFL network, and he was on the desk that night with about 5-6 people, and they're all high-fiving each other and, you know, inflating balloons and all that. And he said, can we just stop for a minute and just think about the people in St. Louis and how they feel? They lost their team through no fault of their own. And there's a lot of people hurting there tonight. And I don't think we should just talk about everything else and ignore those good people in St. Louis. So no matter what Nate Burleson does the rest of his life, I'll always love him.
So let's talk some Cardinals. Bern, I know it's only been 2 or 3 games, but I'm loving me some Sajacy. He feels like a 1974 player to me somehow. I like everything about him. Should I enjoy this stint because he may not be back up much next year?
No, he'll be on the team next year. I mean, barring injury, you know. They have big plans for him. He'll play a lot because he can play shortstop. He can play second base. He could play third base. He could probably put him in the outfield. So he'll go into a super utility role, which means he'll be very, very busy. He's a gamer. It's a cliche. He's a dirt player, which is a compliment.
Yeah.
You know, he hits the ball to all fields. He's got easy power. He does a lot of things very, very well. And he let's face it, the Cardinals are having a hard time entertaining their fans. So JC is the type of kid that everyone will root for because he's not a big, strong guy. You know, he didn't come out of the draft as like this big, oh, this guy's going to be a star. And just the way he plays, the way he gets after it, that's the kind of player that Cardinals fans for many generations have loved.
This is the fascinating, and Dave brought it up earlier. We were talking about, the Cardinals seem to have a lot of players, and I tend to agree with this, that fit into that similar category, not style-wise, but positionally. Right, you got a lot of guys that are second base, left field.
You got a lot of B-minus utility guys.
So they
got
to sort through Gorman, Donovan, Sejesi, Nootbaar, Walker, Burleson, Baker, and that's all without even considering going outside and maybe trying to get better. I find that to be fascinating, and it's not the exact same thing they've had to do in the outfield in the last few years, Bernie, but it's the same idea, right? Do they have to sort through that, in your opinion, and maybe move some out to move others in?
Well, they've always got to sort things out because they somehow create these positional log jams. and then, you know, it's like all of a sudden you have, I'm just being hypothetical and a little bit, I'm exaggerating on purpose, you know, where you go years where you don't have a player at a certain position. And then all of a sudden you have like seven of them at the same position. You know, it's like, I don't know how this stuff happens, but it's kind of happening again. Listen, this is not a good offense, and all the stats spare that out.
Right.
And I hate to be Mr. Doug Downer, but as is, I don't have a lot of confidence that this would be a good offense next season. You know, Goldie may not be back. Arenado's an old 33. He'll be 34 next year. I'd love to say, oh, yeah, Jordan Walker, Nolan Gorman, they'll be back to, you know, what we thought they would be. I can't say that with any confidence. And right on down the line.
Yeah.
Listen, I try to be pragmatic and realistic about stuff. If they erupt and they have a good offense next year, I'll be happy to eat crow. I don't see it. There's just not a lot you can bank on given what they have. So to your point, they might have to go to the outside to get some offense.
It's going to be interesting. And I was thinking about this, too, on the same front, on the pitching side, right? We know that Sonny Gray, Eric Fetty, Miles Michaelis, Steven Matz, they're all under contract. Andre Pallante is under team control. Gibson and Lynn have options. You can't run that same group out again next year, right? I mean, Fetty and Gray, perfectly fine. Pallante's pitched really well, and some of the underlying stuff's even better than his real numbers. But, like, how do you sort that out? Is it as simple as you let the other old guys go and find another guy that fits up there at the top with Sonny?
They're going to have to take a look. I would hope that sometime at some point in 2025 that, you know, we'll see Quinn Matthews up here and Tink Hentz if he can stay healthy. You know, MLB.com came out with a piece rating the top 11 farm systems in terms of pitching, and the Cardinals were at number 3.
All right. Hmm.
So the people outside of St. Louis, neutral parties, third parties, think the Cardinals are, you know, finally have got some pitching on the way. So we'll see. But listen, it's a tough situation. They've boxed themselves in because they have guaranteed money for Miles Michaelis for another year. And there's really no way to get around that unless they're willing to eat 16 and a half, 17 million.
Yeah.
And listen, this is not an opinion. All you got to do is go to FanGraphs. Miles Michaelis has been one of the two or three worst starting pitchers in the majors the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And he can't strike people out and he can't get the swing and miss stuff. So what do you do? Like, in other words, like Miles Michaelis ain't going to come back and be younger or throw harder or get a bunch of strikeouts. He's going to be more vulnerable. So I don't know how they fix this. I really, really don't know how they're going to fix this. But that's why it's a huge offseason for the Cardinals.
Andrew, you ready for your Friday the 13th to get worse?
Got a fever of 100.
Are you ready for it to get worse?
Let's do it.
How many ounces a day do you think you drink of energy drinks?
Oh, man. Well, what do we got here? This is 355 milliliters.
So what's that one? You got a Red Bull there?
Yeah, I got a Red Bull. I got 12, So let's say at least 12, not counting other sources of caffeine. Let's say at least 12.
At least one energy drink a day?
Sure.
Or more?
Sure. You know.
Is it one or is it more? I mean, I know you're drinking things like Mountain Dew or whatever.
I'll say it's usually one.
All right. So you're probably not too bad off.
Okay.
But energy drinks are obviously horrible for people.
No, I don't think that's
absolutely
true.
Absolutely. I got a doctor here who's talking about it. Now, sounds like unless you're drinking tons and tons and tons of Mountain Dew or Cokes or Pepsis, you're probably not in that real danger zone of too much caffeine in a day. Like 400 milligrams of caffeine in a day is considered dangerous by doctors.
Okay, so what if you are doing that?
Well, you can have heart problems, of course. We know that. But it also can make anxiety worse and kill your sleep. And also dehydrate you, by the way, because caffeine does that. It's one of the things that caffeine does is it makes you pee a lot, which dehydrates you.
Interesting.
So there are many, many, many negative health implications for that. And you feel, so the way the doctor described it was, you feel better because the caffeine gets your brain going and you're like, woo, I feel good.
Uh-huh.
But you're actually doing damage and you're not going to sleep as well. You're not going to recover. You're not going to recover as well. And it's going to have a much longer lasting negative effect over time, as opposed to just not doing them and sleeping better and eating better.
Yeah, I don't want to eat better. Everybody keeps telling me to do that, and I'm like,
it doesn't mean stop eating good stuff. It just means eat some things that will make you feel better.
Like what? How am I supposed to know?
I don't know. Like asparagus or something.
That's why I'm so excited to take this genetic test thing.
That'll be cool. I just want to make sure I'm looking out for you, dude, because I know that, and part of the story is like, and by the way, parents that are listening, this isn't just about Andrew. If you have teenagers that love energy drinks, rein them in. It's not good for them. I coach baseball players. I have to, in the summertime, ban them. Because they all want, you know, a 9 o'clock game. I need an energy drink. You're a teenager. You don't need energy. You just need to wake up. Just get up a little earlier, eat a good breakfast. You'll be fine. Energy drinks are terrible for athletic competition. Terrible for athletic competition. Do not do them. Again, they dehydrate you. It's a terrible thing, that combination. Sports drinks and energy drinks, by the way, not the same things. Also important to note that distinction. All right, conversation with Ricky Horton coming up in a few minutes. He's coming at us from Toronto. Cardinals and the Blue Jays at Rogers Center tonight. I don't know why Toronto does this. Their games are at 6:07.
Weird.
Which means pregame starts at 5:12. Pick a round number.
Is it a French thing?
That's not French Canada.
That's a French thing.
French Canada, that's at the province of Ontario. Ontario is basically like Michigan. And then you get into Quebec, that is French Canada, the province of Quebec, and obviously Montreal is in there. I don't know why, but it makes things weird. I don't know. The human mind likes fives and zeros, you know, 6:05, 6 o'clock, 7:15, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why these dummies have picked. It's probably a sponsorship thing would be my guess. There's probably a sponsor that has a seven somewhere in it, like 7:11. Mm-hmm. And then they started. Game time is your 7:11, 6:07. I'm sure it's something like that. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Anyway, that's what time it starts tonight, 5:12 for the pregame show. Matt Pauly will have you covered from Toronto, by the way. And then, obviously, 6:07 will be the first pitch coming up tonight. Andrew, baseball thing.
Yeah.
You always try to trip me up. You're always trying to catch me on a baseball thing that I didn't know.
Yeah.
Or that I had never heard of before. Yeah. How many times has that worked for you?
Never.
Okay. I found one today that I had never heard before.
Okay.
Guy was drafted by the Minnesota Twins in the sixth round just this year. Mm-hmm. So 2024.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing in a minor league playoff game, an elimination game, win or go home.
Okay.
And he starts telling the opposing team's hitters what's coming.
Mm.
What pitch is coming. And they're crushing it, and his team loses.
How was he telling the pitchers?
He's telling the hitters. He's catching. He's telling the hitter, fastball down the middle.
Hey, it's going to be a fastball.
Breaking ball away.
Oh.
Change up. He's telling them. They get rocked because he's telling them, and he gets released the next day because the other team comes in and tells his team, hey, your guy was telling us what was coming.
As well as
you. Do you know why he did that?
Because he was tired of playing.
He wanted the season to be over.
Yeah. He's tired of playing.
He could have just faked an injury, and he just ended his career.
You want to go on a trip?
Yeah, I just need to go home. Well, guess what? Plenty of time to sit at home now.
Welcome back, guys. DGS. Time to talk to our pal, Ricky Horton. What's up, Rick?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. So I am dreading next Tuesday. You know why?
Uh-oh.
We have Ozzie Smith on, and he's in studio, and he still thinks that I'm his best friend. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Wow, you can't have two best friends, you
Tell
know.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, I get
it. That's my problem.
I'm feeling, we'll keep that a secret between you and I. Go ahead and tell him that, and I can live with it. I'm okay.
This is why he's the best.
Yeah.
He's the absolute best.
Only for a day, though. Don't tell me I got to do it for more than that.
Okay, fair enough. That's fair enough. Hey, you had a couple days off there. Did you enjoy yourself?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah, days off are always fun, and, you know, kind of recharge. And, of course, you know, we're in the final stretch here, and I think we're going to find out. By the way, during this final stretch, you can find out a lot about players and kind of people when, you know, you're kind of just finishing out a season. And, of course, you still got to play. You still try to win. You're six games out in the wild card. You know, crazier things have happened. Not many. But the point is you just kind of find out, you know, who the winners are, I think. And I think Cardinals are going to be checking that out over the next 2.5 weeks.
We had a discussion in the first hour about the Cardinals, and I said to Wheels that we seem to have an embarrassment of riches at a certain level of guys, you know, like the Sajaces and the Gormans and people like that. And Wheels, I think you called them like B-plus players, that we do have a lot of those players.
Well, I think that's true. I think the idea is you want them to be what we always say is they need to be finished as big league players. And you know, we get a lot of guys that are right up to that line and you're thinking, "Oh boy," and then you just kind of want them to go that next step. And it doesn't mean that they won't. And I think they're going to be guys that are going to get that opportunity going forward to kind of finish off their development, but everybody understands now in baseball development doesn't stop in the minor leagues. It used to. You used to get ready for the big leagues, then you'd play, but now the development continues and there's a few guys that you're still kind of in that wait and see mode on.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, Rick, because obviously players are reaching the big leagues younger. I mean, that's just they're fast-tracking players. Because they have the physical abilities, the training starts so much earlier, you're not learning how to throw hard. You're not learning how to hit the ball 108 miles an hour. You're doing those things in high school and college. And by the time you're getting to the pros, you have the physical. But there's more than the physical that goes into it. So, you know, the old standard would be what? Like you want to get 1,000 at-bats before you get to the big leagues. And now a lot of times it's half that or less.
Yeah, I can throw one more thing into this development idea. It's something I got from Mike Schilt when he was managing with the Cardinals. And he said that it's a common understanding among development people that you actually have to have minor league players unlearn some things that they learned in those youth areas and in all the things that they do to kind of, you know, showcase their power and their strength and all that. And you have to kind of teach them that that's not exactly what's going to translate into AA, AAA, and then the big league. So, and it's not like it's a macro change, but it is a change. And you've got guys that are wondering, well, boy, this worked when I was 13. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, we can all say that, can't we?
Oh, my God,
different when we were 13. So I do think that that's part of the process now.
I also wonder, too, and I've heard people in the game talk about this, and you can observe it sometimes, too, but there are times where I'm watching a game or I'm listening to you and John, and you're talking about how guys are learning things like proper way to do a rundown or cutoffs and relays. And when you have less experience doing that, it's hard to learn those things and do them right at the major league level when it matters and there's pressure every day.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'm ready to say this is definitively true, but I've been thinking a lot lately about how, you know, most players that got to the big leagues would have gone to one or two or maybe 3 years of what we used at the time, the phrase was instructional league, which is at the end of the year, you'd go for 6 weeks and you would get, I mean, you'd get baseball basics until it's coming out of your ears. And, you know, in the Cardinal sense, that was run by George Kissel. And you'd learn how to, you know, the six ways to get from second to third on a ball hit to the left side of the infield. Even I know those or how to bunt and where to bunt and when to bunt and, how, you know, all that stuff and relays and cutoffs. And you'd get that, I mean, until you just couldn't stand it anymore. But the point was you're making a guy learn those things so he can just do them instinctively on the baseball field. And we're not doing doing that anymore. We don't have instruction. Now, we have other things, but I'm not so sure that that's not a big miss for the development of baseball players right now.
So, generally speaking, I'm sure it's different for each guy and for each coach, but generally speaking, do the guys from Central America get to the big leagues better prepared, more basic sound players than the American guys?
Boy, that's a good question. I would say yes, marginally so. I mean, I feel like they have some experience competing against the best of the best. That's part of what it's like playing winter ball. I think winter ball is their instructional league. Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to winter ball, I mean, you'll be, as an American player, it would have been, you know, a triple-A type guy who's getting ready to be a big leaguer, and you go to the winter ball to kind of hone your skills, and you're playing with, you know, some current big league players that just that love to represent their country in winter ball, and they still, Tony Pena was playing until he was in his late 30s, I think, and he just never stopped. He would always play winter ball. Many guys would do that, but they would also have these young guys, these 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds that are learning from these big leaguers, and I think, you know, being around big leaguers is a great lesson. There's no question.
It's a fascinating topic, Rick, because having been involved with youth sports for so long, youth baseball for so long, it's funny, a lot of the training that we talk about is because these are the skill sets that show this will get you drafted.
Right.
This is what the team demands. This is what the top SEC schools demand if you want to go there. So you have to give them that, but it's at the expense of something.
Yeah, and so many people have said this. John Mozeliak said this recently. I was on an MLB call last week with all the broadcasters. They said it out of the Major League Baseball office. We can't blame youth leagues. I mean, we're drafting them. We're doing it. We're saying this is the most important thing for us to sign you, and then we're saying, boy, they just don't know how to use all four corners of the plate. Well, I mean, that's part of the deal. And so, you know, you can't kind of keep doing the same thing expecting the better results. So I do think you have to take ownership of that. Baseball, I believe, is understanding that we have to kind of maybe teach a little bit differently.
All right, buddy, enjoy it up north, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys. Good to be with you.